IVM
Public policy affects every aspect of your life, from the roads near your home and the lakes in your city, to education and health, to international trade and foreign policy. If you want to understand this interplay of politics, economics, polity and governance, Takshashila Institution's public policy courses are made just for you. The 12-week graduate certificate program gives you a window into the basics of public policy. You can choose to explore the areas of defense and foreign affairs, tech and policy, or advanced public policy. The course is completely online and is conducted on weekends, making it a perfect fit for working professionals. The applications for the May 2024 cohort are now open. Visit school.takshashila.org.in. For more information, visit www.school.takshashila.org.in or click the link in the show notes.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast brought to you by the Takshashila Institution. I'm your host, Winifred Guru, Communications Manager at the Institute. In the last couple of years, we have witnessed a significant rise in India's position in the world order. With this, its foreign policy is under constant scrutiny. So today we delve into the complexities of India's foreign policy, exploring its perspectives on the global landscape, significant shifts in approach over the past decade, and the challenges and opportunities it faces in an ever-changing world. We also examine the dynamics of India's partnership with other countries against the backdrop of shifting geopolitical realities, and assess the influence of think tanks and social media on shaping India's foreign policy discourse. In addition to this, we will also explore the key challenges and opportunities that lie ahead post the 2024 general elections and how they might shape the country's foreign policy agenda. To discuss this, we have a very special guest with us today, Professor C. Rajamohan, who is a visiting research professor at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore and was previously the director of the Institute. He is also a columnist for the Indian Express. Welcome to All Things Policy, Prof.
Thank you, Vinay. Thank you for inviting me.
To get the ball rolling for our listeners, how would you characterize India's current perspective on the global landscape? So from New Delhi's point, what do you think are the key features of the world today, and how does India envisage its role within it?
Yeah, I think what the fundamental feature of India's engagement with the world today, I think, is a sense of self-awareness that India's relative position in the international system is growing, is rising, if you will. Because as Prime Minister Modi keeps talking about, that 10 years ago, India was in the 11th position in terms of aggregate GDP. Today, 10 years later, it is at the 5th position. And all indicators are that India will be the third largest economy in the next 5 years, given the way the Japanese and the German economies, the two countries ahead of India in the list of five, that it's a matter of time that India will overtake both of them in the coming years, because India's growth rates are doing well. Japan and Germany are not doing so well. So therefore, I think it's just a question of next 2 to 3 years, if not next five, when India will get ahead of Germany and Japan as the third largest aggregate economy. So this is, I think, will mark a historic shift in India's position in the hierarchy of the international system. That is, historically, we've seen ourselves as a weak developing country. There are issues about that. We'll come back to that. But the India's absolute growth in India's economy, and today, India is around close to $3.8 trillion. And that the size of that economy gives India capabilities, which a normal developing country does not. So I think given its size and its aggregate GDP today that India has, its position, you can say, vis-a-vis the other countries has significantly improved. And I think in the past, we were ambivalent about it. For example, in the previous government, the UPA government said, no, we don't want to be a major power. We don't like being thought of as a major power because India is poor, India has a whole lot of challenges. While the challenges are real and true, but the fact is also, you will be the third largest. So I think just as it happened in the case of China, China too, in terms of per capita income, is way behind the United States, but in aggregate terms, it's almost close to the United States. Because you are one country, you can spend on defense, which the other countries can't, the smaller countries can't. So with around $10,000, $12,000 per capita GDP, China has become the second largest economy, second biggest military power. So I think the size has effects on India's position in the international system. Therefore, as a collective, for example, if you're a country with large income and large size, India can do a moon mission, but Singapore can't do it because Singapore might have $70,000, $80,000 per capita income, and India has only less than $3,000 per capita income. But given the overall size of the pie, that you can do things which a small country cannot do, even if it is very, very rich. So I think that is the fundamental change that has taken place. And I think this is combined with Prime Minister Modi's exhortation, claim that, look, India is on an upward trajectory. India is going to be a major power. We're going to shape and influence the world. So that has enthused a large number of your population. Also, there is a sense of this nationalist sense of rise. And I think that is the big change that has taken place. And given India's size, and I think it has given a lot of self-confidence, self-assurance, and backed by a strong leader, that India's diplomacy has acquired a new edge, a new sense of being able to handle difficult issues, of contributing to global situations, global priorities. So in many ways, I think the change in India's absolute power, which is today we are at nearly $4 trillion, and change in the relative position, that India is almost will soon be the third largest economy, have together given India a position in the international system that it did not have before. And I think that's what is going to drive the way India is going to relate to the world. But at the same time, as we said, the per capita income is still only less than $3,000. So India has a lot of challenges of development within. But the size gives you leverage, opportunities, market size, technological capabilities. So how does India use its improved international position to raise the living standards of its people, to bring more prosperity to our people, and to produce peace in the region? So those would be the objectives. So both are true. India's absolute weight in the international system has gone. Its relative position has gone. But at the same time, given the low per capita income, it has a huge number of developmental challenges to overcome. So the key to conclude this part is, how do you use your global influence to accelerate India's growth and prosperity at home?
So I wanted to go a bit to the past, right? The last decade. So what significant substantive and stylistic shifts have you observed in Indian foreign policy? And also, how do you think these changes have shaped the country's approach to international relations?
Yeah, as I said, there's far greater sense of self-assurance. And I think what's happened is, if you take the period between when Rajiv Gandhi stepped down as Prime Minister, his term came to an end in 89. From 89 to 2014, we had a series of coalition governments. Sometimes 25, sometimes 26 parties, that while India was finally on a path of economic reform, its economy was beginning to perform well. But I think the absence of political coherence at the center meant the ability of the government to project its capacities and power on the international system were weak. because there were so many parties, and the Prime Minister did not have a majority in the Lok Sabha. So that put enormous constraints on successive coalition governments that came. So what has changed in 2014 is that Mr. Modi got elected with an absolute majority in the Lok Sabha. And in 2019, he improved that majority. So what you have is a leader with a clear, solid majority at home. And he also has the total dominance over his own party. Because in parliamentary systems, even if you have a majority, you can't control your own party. We've seen in the case of the British Conservative Party, a series of OPMs, despite the fact that they won a big victory. They had almost four prime ministers, and Britain is not doing too well. So I think Modi's leadership over his own party, his dominance over his own party, its majority in the Lok Sabha, has given a government a capacity to do things which the previous coalition governments did not. So I think, so when you have a foreign interlocutor comes to meet a foreign Indian prime minister and says, look, let's do this deal. So the other side is confident you can get things done if you're strong at home. We've seen how difficult it was for Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to get what was a sensible nuclear deal with the United States approved at home, because his own party, there was opposition. Left coalition partners opposed it. There's huge amount of noise and, you know, opposition in the parliament. So what you had was really even what sensible things could not be done because of weak coalition governments. So therefore today, India's credibility as a partner has gone up. The size of its market has gone up. Therefore, for example, it was impossible, I think, in any previous recent governments, that on the semiconductor mission, within 1 year of announcing the mission, we actually launch three major production facilities for semiconductors all in 1 year. So having a strong government that can actually deliver things, you know, improves the credibility. And I think that's where India is enjoying that moment where a strong government can get things done. So even when others disagree with you, but if you're a partner who's credible, I think your value goes up in the international system, and people are willing to work with you much more closely if they know that there is a government in Delhi that can deliver if you can negotiate a deal with them.
We also see that there is a growing regional tension and competition, like particularly in the Indo-Pacific, right? So in this context, how do you think India perceives its strategic interests and security concerns? And also, what steps is India taking to strengthen or bolster its defense capabilities and forge partnerships to safeguard its national interests in the region?
Look, I think one big change that has taken place, while India has done well, it has to deal with the Chinese power today. And I think that's where the Chinese have become much stronger than India. Today, per capita, China's aggregate GDP is almost five times bigger than India's, because China has around $17 trillion. Its defense spending is much bigger than India's, and its international weight and influence has dramatically grown. So I think the problems with China have grown. Even as India has become stronger, China is even more powerful. And the gap in the national power between China and India has dramatically grown. Therefore, India's challenge is to manage this power gap. How does it do it? Because it is not just what we've seen happen with China. For example, on the boundary, we've seen a series of tensions build up. We had a military crisis in 2013, 2014, 2017, 2020. We've seen China constantly gain ground in relation to India in, for example, in Maldives. With Pakistan, of course, they always had a great relationship. And so what China does in India's neighborhood has begun to undermine, to some extent, India's position in the region. So therefore, India is trying to push back. And in the broader Indian Ocean, too, now China, which was not a player in the Indian Ocean, is now becoming a player. Over the last 10, 15 years, some Chinese naval presence has grown. Its first military base is in the Indian Ocean in Djibouti, a permanent presence of Chinese naval carriers in India. And then you have the economic challenges vis-a-vis China. You have China seen as blocking India's aspirations on the multilateral stage. China has not supported India's candidature for permanent membership of the Security Council. And it has blocked India's entry into the nuclear suppliers group. So I think it's an all-encompassing challenge that India faces from China. So therefore, dealing with this has become a major question for India. And that in turn has led to rethinking our region as the Indo-Pacific, in which today, unlike in the past, that India is willing to work with the United States, both to strengthen its own capabilities, as well as to partner the United States in building a more balanced, stable architecture in the Indo-Pacific.
Let's now move to the mushrooming of think tanks and social media, right? So how do you assess the influence of think tanks and media in shaping foreign policy discourse and policy making in India? And also, what roles do you think these institutions play in facilitating informed decision making and public engagement on international affairs?
I think it's a dramatic explosion of India's think tank space over the last 20 years, and in the last few years. In fact, I would say in the 21st century, there's been a dramatic growth in the number of think tanks. There is also the expansion of the public square. I think the emergence of the social media, the demand for participation in public discourses, we see think tankers everywhere. We've also seen in the last few years, I mean, the scale and quality, the scale and intensity of India's engagement with the world has grown. As we said, look, as India approaches the $4 trillion economy, its weight in the region and in the world has increased. So therefore, the demand for dealing with the issues, whether it's global issues, regional issues, technical issues, technological issues, policy issues, that demand has grown. And I think the government sector remains relatively, small, in terms of that we always talk about capability question, the size of India's bureaucracy, not dealing with global issues is small. Therefore, I think there is a space for think tanks to contribute to this discourse, to generate ideas, to widen the discourse on policy, because today the public square is a big one. Unlike last century, that really there was not much of a public square, but today, because of social media, because of and the rise of the think tanks, you have a much wider opportunity to engage with these issues in the public. But I would say the performance of the think tanks has been somewhat mixed, I would say, because the tendency, I think, for many think tanks is to stay five steps behind the government rather than suggest alternatives. I mean, it's not that, I'm not saying it's not job of the think tanks to take sides between the, those are political think tanks, the political party's job to argue, contest. But I think the think tanks presumably will be neutral, objective in terms of not framing it as an anti-government or pro-opposition, but to be able to offer alternatives to policy discourse, to suggest improvements to existing policies, and also to kind of point to the over-the-horizon issues that are coming. For example, 5 years back, much work saying, look, here is AI-related issues are now coming to the fore. How does India deal with it? How should India deal with it? So I think the job of seeing over the horizon, alerting Indian establishment or the Indian public square to start thinking about these issues. I think in this, I would say maybe Takshashila Institute is an exception because I think they do exceptional policy work as well as issues relating to technology. But as a general rule, that the think tanks have tended to lag rather than lead. For example, I mean, my own experience when it came to the nuclear deal, most of the think tanks were actually raising concerns, raising fears, raising suspicions, rather than contribute to a more objective kind of debate. So there is a lot of room, and my sense is that there is a danger in a polarized environment and a tendency to either, simply keep clapping for the government and join the opposition, simply attack the government, whatever it does. So there is that danger, and I think, but my sense is offering policy, more informed discourse of policy, offering alternatives, warning against future dangers, and doing some of the hard work with quantitative work that, of course, that kind of Takshashila has done some of that work For example, on a range of issues, what is the best way to understand a particular issue? I think that kind of work, we need more. So I would say we need more Takshashila institutions, certainly in Delhi, which is far more, shall we say, too close to the decision-making bodies here.
There's also been a rise of non-state actors and transnational challenges, such as climate change, terrorism, and pandemics, right? So how does India prioritize these issues in its foreign policy agenda? And also, what collaborative approaches would you suggest India pursue to address these global challenges effectively?
No, I think climate change is a huge issue. And we've seen the government of India actually in the last 10 years under PM Modi to actually change its policy to emphasize that India is going to be part of the solution and the need to work. And I think here we've seen the government actually listen to far more advice from technical and competent institutions outside the government to engage with the global debates. So I think this is going to be a big issue. We've also seen the Modi government facilitate a number of new dialogues. I mean, you had the Raisina dialogue that brings in not only people from the rest of the world's foreign policy establishments, policies, media, think tanks, convened in Delhi, which has become a major landmark in the global calendar. Similarly, the Carnegie's technology dialogue. So I think this is the way to go, to be able to create platforms in India that bring together global policy community to debate. That is the way to go. But I think it doesn't have to be everything on such a huge scale. I think there are room there for smaller groups to work together. For example, some of the work that Takshashila is doing on what is the case for a space act or on space policy, how does privatization work? Those are the kind of rules, work that I think we need to do a lot more of that. And I think there's a lot of possibilities for that.
So finally, now with the general elections coming up, what are the three significant challenges and opportunities that you anticipate, regardless of which party assumes power? And how might these factors shape India's foreign policy agenda in the coming years?
No, one, I would say dealing with the big changes in the United States. I mean, India has had a good relationship when President Trump was in power. We've had an excellent relationship with Biden in power. So in that sense, it does not seem to be a challenge. But my sense is if Trump comes back, there'll be some big moves on the trade issue where there could be complications for India. And I think India needs to be prepared to deal with the whole question of trade and trade rules and how the trade rules are going to be reformulated under Trump. And even Biden has largely continued those policies. So I think India has some trade pacts to negotiate with the EU, with Britain, with Oman. Some of those have slowed down. Some of them are moving fast. So I think, and with the US, of course, is our biggest trading partner. So I think India should be prepared for a rethink of its own trade policies and how does it cope with a change in the global trading system that is beginning to unfold. The second, I would say, is in our own neighborhood. I mean, some important things are happening. For example, if you look at the Pakistan-Afghanistan border, Pakistan's border with Iran, there is a lot of restiveness. There is a lot of return of terrorism, return of religious violence. So I think we got to think through, how does this neighborhood west of India, given the current pressures that are operating, if these pressures build up, how does India deal with Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran in our western neighborhood becomes very, very important, given the nature of the destabilization that is unfolding. Similarly, I would say on the east, we see a serious crisis developing in northern Burma, where the current government in Yangon is losing ground. There is, the opposition groups have united and there is fighting going on. So I think if any further breakdown of the state capacity in Burma takes place, it will have huge consequences in the north, to our northeastern region, to China's role in the region. So therefore, I think here again, we should be prepared to deal with major changes on our eastern frontier as well. And of course, we have problems with the Chinese on the northern frontiers. So I think some way of integrated view of preventing unexpected dangers from coming together is an important thing. Third priority, I would say, is the global efforts at negotiating new rules for artificial intelligence. are gaining ground. There, I would say, I think India will need to really, India's talking a lot about it, it's creating capabilities, but I think India must now, must not leave it to US and China to shape the new rules. So it must actively participate in shaping the global agenda on how to govern artificial intelligence. So I would say rethinking the global economic order, rethinking our frontiers, and taking leadership in the management of the new technologies like artificial intelligence. So those are the three priorities.
Thank you so much, Prof. Mohan, for joining us today and sharing your wonderful insights. I'm sure not just me, but the listeners also learned a lot from this discussion. We look forward to hosting you again.
Thank you, Vinny.
If you liked our show, dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs. Check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.